I'm Jack Neely. I'm Executive Director of the Knoxville History Project.
I'm Paul James, the Development Director with the Knoxville History Project.
The Knoxville History Project, to me, just sounds huge. What was the genesis of it? When was there a spark when someone said, we must do this?
Well, I'd wondered for years why we don't have a historical group in Knoxville about the city of Knoxville. And I think one of the reasons is we have this wonderful organization, the East Tennessee Historical Society, which is a 35-county organization, big regional organization. It's for the whole of East Tennessee from Bristol to Chattanooga. They don't concentrate on any one city, and that's why when you go to the museum downtown, you see stuff about Chattanooga and stuff about Johnson City and other places. But Knoxville has its own distinctive history, as you know, and as anybody that lives here for a long time does. That we have different demographics, different economic base, that sort of thing from across the ages. And I'd always wonder why we don't have something. Even Farragut has its own historical group, but Knoxville never has. And I always wondered about that. And then, of course, when we were suddenly looking for work after the end of Metropulse, I thought, gosh, is there a nonprofit way to keep going, to keep telling these stories, to have a reason to keep researching stories? And, of course, we had a weekly called The Mercury that we were the founding partner of sort of in the early days. And that was one of our main roles for the time The Mercury lasted. But The Mercury closed over a year ago, and we're now still here as a historical nonprofit, and we're a more conventional educational nonprofit now, just a conduit for information about the city of Knoxville. We tell the story of the city of Knoxville, which is unlike the story of any other city in many ways.
And you tell the story to whom?
To anybody that's interested. Honestly, I do a lot of stuff for tourists who've never, a couple weeks ago, I gave a boat tour to people from around America who were with a T-Bird convention, and a lot of them had never set foot in Tennessee before, and they were just getting a completely explaining the very basics to them. It was almost like a kindergarten course in Knoxville. To people I work with, grad students at UT who are working on projects having to do with Knoxville history, and we work with other more sophisticated things. We recently did a thing with the Veterans Affairs Administration out of Washington about the National Cemetery, which has never had a history written of it until we produced one last spring in time for Memorial Day. But we really at every level we work with professors and tourists and everybody in between.
Even just the basic knowledge of a history of a place can change your experience with it. Yeah. I recently went out to San Jose for a jazz conference. But when I got to San Jose, I realized I knew nothing beyond the Dionne Warwick song.
Yeah. Did you know the way there, by the way?
Well, it was a train directly from San Francisco, so someone knew the way. Yeah. And I just enjoyed the trip in. But that's it. That's all I really knew about it. I knew it was in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And I went into a bookstore and just said, is there a book on, the history of San Jose or what's it good? And they're like, I don't know. But when I go to a city, I always try to find out the history of it, even basically, and it just changes the whole experience.
Yes, I think the history is the fourth dimension of a place. I think you can't understand any place until you learn the history of it. And anybody that travels in Europe or anywhere else, part of the travel is learning the history of each place. It's the story of the place you're going to. Why is this place important? Why is this worth looking at? So it really is essential, I think, to describing any place, especially a city like Knoxville.
And if you went into a bookstore in Knoxville today and asked for a Knoxville history guide, there isn't one. But by November, there is going to be one. We're producing one that's going to be out just in time for the end of the year.
What's the name of it?
Knoxville History Guide. So far.
Knoxville History Guide. But it's going to have, an overview of the history of Knoxville, timeline, pull-out maps, historic parks, gardens, cemeteries, statues, even the University of Tennessee, which is a fantastic slice of history itself. And I think will mean a lot to people that don't, not connected with it on every day, because we all drive by or through it or near it or see it. But there's just a fascinating history of just this campus, never mind anything else.
Yeah, just Circle Park. You look here and then see all these modern people assuming it was established landscape for the University of Tennessee. But Circle Park was here in the 1880s when this was a residential community, and it had its own history before that, and has has legendary connections to Frederick Law Olmsted, believe it or not, who is believed to have had something to do with this in the 1880s and early 90s. But then goes on through, they played neighborhood football in Circle Park, and over the years there's been concerts there and lectures and demonstrations and speeches and all sorts of things. That just this one spot has lots and lots of history to it.
And that's kind of amazing because they didn't put something on top of it.
Yeah. Yeah, they did save the park. They tore down the houses, but they saved the park. And the park was, I think, maybe the most unique thing about the place. There were some beautiful Victorian houses that UT didn't need, and they took them away. But the park, they said, we can use this park. And obviously, it's used every game day, but every single day on campus, people walk through it and just enjoy the piece of the greenery of it.
You can get a free hot dog out there sometimes.
Oh, no kidding.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, well, call me next time.
Yeah, I'll give you a clue about when it is, send you a secret text. Now, Paul, I can, I'm a student of dialects and languages, and I can tell from your dialect that you're not from Knoxville. I'm thinking Oak Ridge or Norris.
Yeah. Georgia way of New York, I guess, but from England originally. Yeah. I was 26 when I moved to the States.
All right, and so how did you... What's your path? How did you go from England to Knoxville?
Well, I moved over to the U.S. in the 90s and used to work for the University of Derby in where I grew up. And
Derbyshire.
Derbyshire, indeed. Beautiful place. Yep. To cut a very long story short, I moved here at the end of 1999, and I was the director at IAMS Nature Center for about 12 years, worked at IAMS for 16 total. And one of the historical things that I did, I wrote a book and helped the Heartland Series do a special documentary on the Iams family. It's part of the 100th anniversary of their kind of family legacy in 2010. And Jack and I kind of hooked up, I was kind of quizzing him. Who else would you go to ask certain questions about Knoxville history? It would be Jack Neely. And, we've kind of kept in touch and worked on a couple of things here and there. When he did a Knoxville Green by Nature book, he interviewed me for that. And when it was time for me to do something different back in 2016, Jack and I had a glass of wine, and a few months later,
I think you were having the wine. I was having some beer, probably.
You probably had the beer, but it was an opportunity to do something fresh, but also to build on something that I was interested in. And yeah, when you talk about Knoxville history, my accent does stand out, obviously. But it's just an amazing place. Yeah,
one of my points is his accent shouldn't stand out because Knoxville has always been full of immigrants. We once had an Englishman who was mayor of Knoxville, Joseph Jacques, in the 1870s and 80s. And over the years, we've had German people, German immigrants, Swiss immigrants,
Czech.
But people even in elected officials who have been in charge of the place have been from other countries. That's been constantly part of the Knoxville story from 1791 to the present day. And there was never a time when this was a city made up overwhelmingly of local people. It was always people from other places, and that's one of the great strengths. That people, new ideas and new perspectives, that keep the place moving.
And that's something I've sort of reflected on in my own experience with Knoxville. I didn't even think about it at the time, but in high school, almost all of my friends were not born here. Mm-hmm. And all of their parents were from not only from outside of Tennessee, but outside of the United States. And I realized I had this really almost international and national group of friends who were all 100% Knoxvillian.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
it was a neat thing. And I'm wondering if that sort of shaped my view of the world, because mm-hmm. Knoxville, also being a college town, and you have Oak Ridge and everything else, it's a lot more international than people think it is.
It is. It's a mix. And even things that we think of as purely local, like country music, have these crazy international influences, like the dobro, for example, which was introduced in Knoxville in 1935, more or less, through Ray Acuff's band. People had never heard this thing before, this crazy-sounding instrument. But the dobro was created by some Hungarian brothers on the West Coast in Oakland, I think, who were trying to capitalize on the Hawaiian music craze from the 1920s. And they started playing with this resonator guitar thing and came up with a dobro. And unfortunately, they missed the Hawaiian music craze. It was just over by the time they perfected it. But there was this loony mountain kid in East Tennessee named Clell Summey. Began playing around with this thing and kind of astonishing his friends and neighbors with it at a drugstore on Broadway. And Roy Acuff walked in there and heard this bizarre sound otherworldly sound of the dobro and said, I want that in my band. And so he got it in the band and recorded Great Speckled Bird. The first dobro hit in world history was – but you see that connection between Hungarians and Hawaiians and mountain guys and Roy Acuff, who is a local guy. But all these influences come in from different places. The banjo, of course, from Africa originally, and all these things that we think of as local Appalachian really have exotic influences.
Yeah, and you mentioned Roy Acuff. Your newest book, or one of your newest books, Knoxville Blues.
Yeah.
And it talks about Roy Acuff in there. And I got to meet Roy Acuff when he was an exhibit at Opryland.
No kidding. Wow.
Did you know that he was like an exhibit at Opryland?
I've heard people talk about him almost like that way. Tell me. I wish I did. I never did. But tell me about your experience.
Well, it was great. We went to Opryland. My parents took me. And I had read somewhere that Roy Acuff had a little house or something there, and that you could go meet him. I went, it's that easy. I mean, I knew who he was. I liked him. And so, we marched over there, and there he was, just meeting people. That was his job.
Oh, wow.
And then while we were meeting Roy Acuff, someone came in and said, "Who wants to be in a movie?" These kind of things happen all the time. I didn't want to be in a movie. I wanted to go, ride rides and things like that. But my parents said, "We do." And they Robert Altman was filming Nashville.
No kidding.
Yeah, and they got in it. They're in the audience in one of the scenes in Nashville. So anyway, there's a weird side
story.
About
that? Wow, that's amazing. But Roy Acuff, I mean, he was like an exhibit. He was a living legend in our lifetimes. But we don't realize that he was a small-time hood, basically, in Knoxville. He was first an athlete, and like a lot of in high school, and like a lot of athletes in high school, they graduate and they don't know what to do with themselves. And he tried to stay in baseball for a long time. He was a baseball player, and he was being scouted by the New York Yankees at one time and other folks. But he started having heat strokes, and you can't be a baseball player and have heat strokes. So he went into kind of the underworld in a way. Was involved in bootlegging and gambling, and he was arrested for assault a couple times. He was a tough kid, and looked like he was heading in the wrong direction. But he learned to play. He learned to play fiddle from a guy that ran a filling station in Fountain City, and kind of brought this brash new aggressive energy to country music, which was already considered kind of like a museum piece in itself in 1930 or so. But he was this young guy that was bringing this sort of new energy to it that was attractive to boys and young men, so much so that they kept outgrowing each venue they moved into. They were playing on WNOX some, and then they were too big for the WNOX studios. They were actually evicted from the Farragut Hotel when they were there. Not Andrew Johnson Hotel, I'm sorry. But then they moved down the street into an old boxing ring, and they were playing on a boxing ring to a crowd in there. They got too big for that, and they put them in the market hall, and they were market hall held more than 1,000 people. So that was a pretty good venue for a Saturday afternoon show. But then they had a problem because the movie theater proprietor started complaining to the city. The market hall was owned by the city, controlled by the city, and they thought it was unfair for the city to be hosting this event that was taking away from their crowd. They noticed that the crowd for the cowboy movies on matinees on Saturday afternoons were notably smaller when Roy Acuff was playing on Market Square. So they complained to the city, but then he moved on from here to Nashville and bigger things, but. But anyway, it's amazing this sudden event that it wasn't like he was paying homage to a traditional style. He was bringing this whole new kind of crazy energy to this thing. In fact, he called his band the Crazy Tennesseans, and there were sometimes as many as 14 of them on stage. And they weren't dressed up, and they weren't wearing the coats and ties like you're supposed to wear when you're on stage. And they were just kind of these wild country kids, a lot of them, but some of them city kids. But playing, riffing off each other, kind of playing a jazz for strings in a way. But it was a phenomenon, and people were just amazed at kind of the anarchy of this event, this wave that was happening in country music, but which wasn't called country music yet. It was called some people called hillbilly music in those days. But he was kind of bringing a whole new energy to it.
Our gain in the New York Yankees loss.
Yeah, that's right.
You know
what
position he played in baseball?
I think he was an outfielder at one time. He was a really good hitter. That was what he was best known for. They called him Home Run Acuff at one time. But we could look that up. I think he wrote an autobiography. One thing he didn't mention in the autobiography that we came up with in the History Project was that during his life of crime, he was actually shot once and wounded. Was sent to St. Mary's Hospital to recuperate in a bootlegging joint called the Green Lantern Tea Room up in Fountain City, in 1931 or so. But he looked like he was going toward a bad end at that time. He was just this aggressive kid that had nothing to do with his energy until he found music and started doing train noises and stuff like that, all this kind of crazy stuff. And with dobros, this bizarre instrument that nobody had ever heard of before, was part of his draw. But it was this. You start reading old newspapers from 1935, 1937 in Knoxville and realize the electricity of this character and the phenomenon that he was creating, that it was something unlike anything before it.
So you're saying the Green Lantern Tea Room was the front for a bootlegging operation?
As a tea drinker, I take great exception to that mischaracterization of a fine establishment.
Yeah, it was on Hotel Avenue up there near the park. It's hard to picture today.
Yeah, the dope pond there.
Yeah.
This is Flipside. I'm Todd Steed talking with Paul James and Jack Neely from the Knoxville History Project. The Jacobs Building, one of the most fascinating parts of the book, Knoxville Blues, is all of the information about the Jacobs Building, which is very close to where I live, and I've had all sorts of experiences in that building. Can you just give me like a little bit of a picture into something that I found particularly fascinating about the Jacobs Building was that it housed a lot of early R&B.
Yeah.
And not rock and roll or rock and roll before it was called rock and roll. And conversely, not a lot of early rock and roll. So, for example, Fats Domino, yes. Eddie Cochran, the Everly Brothers, no.
Exactly. It was all black rock and roll. It was kind of the rock and roll and the predecessors of rock and roll in R&B. Fats Domino, Little Richard, Chuck Berry, Ike and Tina Turner, who else? Bo Diddley, of course, Big Joe Turner. A lot of these folks who were kind of major figures, Big Mama Thornton, all performed at the Jacob Building in the early to mid-50s. And if you heard rock and roll, the Everly Brothers didn't perform there in concert, but I like to think that they were in the gallery. They allowed white people in the Jacob Building as spectators only to watch these black concerts that were mainly dances on the main floor. But whites were allowed into the mezzanine area, and they could look down and watch the show. And but it had a little background to the Jacob Building. Before that, it was the old exposition building that was built for the 1910 or 1913 exposition. It's one of those early exposition-era expositions. But it was a big, grand building, and it burned down in 1938. And it had a jazz history already when it burned down. It had one of the last shows there was Chick Webb with his young singer Ella Fitzgerald were there at the old exposition building. But they burned down. They replaced it with the Jacob Building, a somewhat simpler building, finished in 1941. But after that, it got its own reputation first in jazz, Duke Ellington, Lionel Hampton, I think Basie was there. Also, Louis Armstrong was there a couple of times. And a friend of mine, Martin Lang, ran across in an estate sale an amazing find. These are pictures of Louis Armstrong and his band at the Jacob Building in 1957. And that's a particularly relevant concert because that was the concert that was bombed by the white supremacists. This was right after the desegregation of Clinton High School. And there was this group, a lot of from outside agitators from other parts of the country came here to protest the Clinton High bombings. And threw a dynamite bomb outside the Jacob Building. It didn't hurt anybody, but blew a big divot out of the landscaping there and scared some people. But Louis Armstrong just stopped for a moment. He was playing Back of Town Blues. And he stopped for just a moment and said, "Don't worry, folks, it was just the telephone." And this went right back into the show. But his biographers think that this might have been the switch that made him more outspoken on civil rights issues. He'd been kind of a guy that just tried to please people and go along. But after this and some other things in the 56, 57 era, he became more outspoken afterwards.
Ever since Susan Johnson lost her Jockey Lee, there has been much excitement and more to be.
Yeah, I remember in his biography they talked about it was shortly after Knoxville where he actually came out and said something about what was going on in Arkansas.
That's right.
Yeah. And one of the great things about radio is you have to use your imagination. But let me just tell you, these pictures are absolutely incredible. I saw one on the internet that had been posted, but I hadn't seen the rest of them. And it's definitely Louis Armstrong. And he looks like he's having a ball despite the idiots, setting off explosives.
Yeah. But that was just part, and this is something, though, that was all at the Jacob Building. This was, I think, at the northern end. And I've confirmed that with some people who remember shows of that era. They said the shows were almost all at the northern end of the building. It's a big, long building, as you know, and it doesn't have many indoor concerts anymore. But back then it had a lot of them, and it's remarkable that even though Elvis didn't come to Knoxville during this time and Buddy Holly didn't come here, and a lot of the major figures didn't perform here. And even though the Everly Brothers lived here, they never did a show in Knoxville until the 1990s when they were a nostalgia act, more or less.
I'll take exception to that.
Well, it was a great show. I won't say that.
It was wonderful.
It was mostly a great hearing audience, though. It wasn't.
I resemble that remark as well.
Yeah.
Well, they did mention in that show that they called us Nashville. Like, it's great to be in Nashville. They actually said that, which to me was a little bit.
Okay, they forgot where they were. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I mean, maybe they were the ones that had the grayest hair of all. But yeah, they came out and said, "Hey, Nashville." And I remember I looked at my wife and went, "I hope that was an inside joke or something."
I bet it was because the show was. They did two shows at the Tennessee Theater in later years, and in one of them, at least, they described having the problem with Kaz Walker at WROL headquarters, which was just two doors down the street at the old Mechanics Bank Building. Up on the fifth floor was where they were performing in Kaz Walker's show, and they apparently had enough of each other. Both of them were kind of careful about what they said about that afterwards. But the story is that Kaz fired the Everly Brothers because they were playing that rock and roll, and I don't know whether that it was that simple or not. But I asked
him about that.
Oh yeah,
yeah. So I live in North Hills, and that's where Kaz lived.
Yeah.
That's
right.
When he went away and then came back, he came back in there, and I moved to North Hills, and I just saw his name on the a mailbox, and I said, "Well, I need to go see him." Yeah, and so I thought my wife said, "Call first." This is in the era of phone books, and I called him, and his nurse answered and said, "Yeah, he'd love to see you," and we mostly talked music. But we talked music quite a bit, and I asked him specifically about the Everly Brothers, and he denied that he fired him. He denied that he said they were hippies or he didn't like their music. He just said, "No, they were fine," and he denied everything about everything. But
on stage, they talked about that they were just dejected and they didn't know what to do. They walked out. They didn't have their show anymore, and walked out. And they both walked in to see whatever was showing at the Tennessee Theater, which was Three Coins in a Mountain. Very kind of silly teen movie about Europe, but they just sat in there and just kind of mulled and sulked and then decided to take Chet Atkins' offer to go to Nashville and work with something different.
That seemed to work out.
Yeah, it did.
So the Knoxville History Project, what do you see it evolving to be? What is it now, and where do you want it to go?
Well, gosh, we're taking each day as it comes, and every day is different. But I want to be eventually the conduit for the history of the city of Knoxville, and I want to use Knoxville's history to raise it. I think people have oversimplified Knoxville over the years, that's why it's kind of a blank in so many people's minds. And if people from other parts of the country come here and don't have any picture of Knoxville in their mind. And I want to change that. I've noticed that even on Wikipedia, it's interesting how often Knoxville is just sort of excised from the biographies of various people. Even Roy Acuff, in fact, I saw a book about had capsule histories of country musicians, and it talked about this guy from the hills of Maynardville moved to Nashville, and it didn't mention the 20 years in between that he was in Knoxville, and when he learned to play the fiddle and began playing music in public and began broadcasting on the radio and began developing his act. That was all in that's a Knoxville story. But I want to be sure that the Knoxville stories get out there. But the idea is through our website, we're always building that, and through other efforts, we do tours and classes and things. We're not right now working toward a museum or anything like that, but we're trying to become a repository for lots of information about Knoxville, both written information and images. Where we have Paul can talk about it.
Yeah, I mean we've got a couple of different programs. We've created this Knoxville History Portal. And it's very visual and engaging. You can go on there and see a whole slew of different facets of Knoxville history, you know, whether it's downtown, Market Square, Gay Street, historic hotels, or the theaters. But also critically, something that's never really been done on a wide scale is communities. So if you live in North Knoxville, you want to learn more about the history of Knoxville. There's been some kind of self-produced community-based books, but what are the other stories out there? You know, and same with West Knoxville, North Knoxville, South Knoxville. There's a lot of, you know, South Knoxville, kind of the new hip thing with Sono and all the urban wilderness and all that and the development down Sevier Avenue. But there's just a lot of stories to be told, whether it's business, schools, churches, the way people live their lives. You know, like in Island Home Park, for example, which I think has done a pretty good job of kind of collating their own story, but it's not very accessible to anyone outside living outside there. And then the flip side of this is how could people in the community contribute to this repository, as Jack was talking about. So on the other side, that card that you're looking at is this idea of Knoxville Shoebox. And, you know, the story that we just talked about of Louis Armstrong is a perfect example of that, that many of us underneath the bed or in the closet, there's a shoebox or a Tupperware box of something, of old photographs of your mother at the Market Square Hall, or, you know, could even be watching Roy Acuff or bands that were playing down on Cumberland Avenue, as we've talked about before. You know, I'm from England. I grew up in the 70s and 80s. So that's, you know, I'm kind of more, in some way, I'm naturally disposed to that. But that's still in the past. That is still, and it's beyond nostalgia. You know, there's a lot of great bands that played in Knoxville or didn't play. Why didn't they play? Did we not have the venues? But people do have records of their lives and of experiences and historical artifacts that we're not asking them to share physically, but they could share digitally and help us build this what's going to become this amazing repository online for people to read and contribute to and all kinds of stuff, really.
Yeah. If you have photographs, if you just want to bring them in, and we can scan them in our office, then that's one way you can do that. There's so much we were talking about just this morning about shows and how it's people argue about who played where, when, and that sort of thing. And we'd like to ultimately one of a thousand things we want to do is to make some sort of an interactive online repository for if you want to look up when was that Iggy Pop show or when was REM first in Knoxville?
December.
You could click on any year and say, okay, who played in Knoxville in 1976, or who are the bands that played at the Civic Coliseum?
Oh yeah,
wouldn't that be cool?
Yeah, would, because people I see people debating it all the time.
Yeah, you know? And see if there anything happened at the show, like the show where is it true the Eagles broke up at the Civic Coliseum? It is sort of true, but talk about the full story of what happened there then.
The website is knoxvillehistoryproject.org. You can try to write that out or just search Knoxville History Project. That's what I do. I just get, search the name of the organization, and somehow someone knows where it is, and you can find everything you want to find there, including how to donate, how to support. It's a deep dive and a wonderful thing.
Thanks, Todd.
Thank you.